This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. If states are laboratories of democracy, then Wisconsin has been one of the most prolific and progressive. It created the first workers' compensation program, the first unemployment insurance program. Wisconsin natives crafted much of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. But lately, the state has undergone a major political shift. Republicans swept state government back in 2010, and the 2016 presidential election was the first time in three decades that it went for a Republican, albeit narrowly. Wisconsin's governor, Scott Walker, said in his campaign, "If our reforms can work in a blue state like Wisconsin, they can work anywhere in America." Does Governor Walker have a point? How did Wisconsin flip from blue to red? And is it a template for conservatives working to turn the political tide in other states? Some of you in Wisconsin have already weighed in on the state's political shift. Here's a bit of what you told us.
This is Gary from Wisconsin. You guys had asked a question on why the state went from blue to red and why we changed. And I'd like to say that I didn't change. My Democratic Party changed. It used to be a party for the working man, the working people, the working women, but it's no longer. They're not trying to protect my rights. They're more interested in the rights of special interest groups. Pick one out. You can do so. But we didn't leave the party. They've left us. I'm now an independent, but I did vote for the Republican President Donald Trump. Would have been my first pick? No.
Hi, this is Robin calling from Delafield, Wisconsin. I live in Waukesha County, which is one of the most conservative counties in the state. And there may have been a shift, however, my own personal shift has been out of the Republican Party and into what I call no man's land. I consider myself now an independent after becoming increasingly alarmed by what I was seeing happen with Donald Trump and the Republican Party, as well as the Democratic Party.
Thank you to Gary and Robin, and we look forward to hearing from more of you if you are a Wisconsinite in or from Wisconsin. What are you seeing as it relates to the state's politics, and how do you feel about that shift? If you were part of the shift in Wisconsin from blue to red, what made you decide to make the switch? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us in studio to discuss it is Dan Kaufman. He's a Wisconsin native. His new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. Dan, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison is Matthew Rothschild, the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. That's a nonprofit that addresses campaign spending in state elections. He's also the longtime former editor of the progressive magazine called The Progressive. Matthew, welcome.
Hey, Joshua. Thanks for having me on.
And in Platteville, Wisconsin, Steve Prestigard is a political blogger in Wisconsin. Steve, thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for the invitation. I think it's Matt's fault if you don't like what I hear, but I appreciate the invitation.
Oh,
talk to everybody.
We will take it out on him later. I'm sure you'll be just fine. But just so we give Steve a few minutes to decide to behave himself for the next hour. Dan, let me start with you and the book. You are a Wisconsinite. You live in New York now, but have been following and reporting on the changes in Wisconsin for a while. Was there a particular moment that made you decide to write this book? Was it just the election of Donald Trump, or was there something else?
I think the book, yes, was catalyzed by the election of Trump, specifically the fact that Wisconsin had put him over the top in the Electoral College. It was a dramatic shift, and what I had been working on for several years is kind of the backstory to that, how the state's political culture had been really transformed by laws undermining labor rights, the environment, voting rights, and other things that had been long established. And I wanted to explore that more deeply. And it seemed like Trump's victory was kind of didn't come out of nowhere. And that's what I was trying to figure out.
And by the way, just by way of reminder, President Trump, then candidate Trump, won Wisconsin with about 1.4 million votes. Hillary Clinton got about 1.38 million. And Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate, got about just under 107,000 votes. Talk a little bit, Dan, about Governor Scott Walker and his agenda. How did that serve as a shift from the state's progressive history? Was there one particular factor that you can point to that kind of allowed Scott Walker to take the governor's mansion?
I think the biggest thing, the most pivotal moment was Act 10, which was, it became called that. It was originally called the Budget Repair Bill. And it was a bill that was introduced shortly after he was inaugurated. He sort of, the bill basically strips public employees of their collective bargaining rights and imposes steep cuts on their pension and healthcare contributions. But what it did also was sort of stoke resentment that may have been there to a degree, but it fueled it. He sort of announced his intention. One, in a public speech, in his inaugural address, he said, "It's, you know, the public employees can no longer be the haves and the taxpayers the have-nots." But privately, he also told a billionaire donor named Diane Hendricks, who asked him if Wisconsin would ever get to be a completely red state, a right-to-work state. This exchange was captured by a documentary filmmaker named Brad Lichtenstein, and Walker said, "Yes, have you heard about what we're going to be doing with the public employees? Because you use divide and conquer."
He used that phrase, divide and conquer.
He did. He did. And then 4 years later, although he had promised not to, he had he signed a right-to-work law, which decimated the private sector unions. So it was an attack on labor, I think, that really set the stage for many of the other transformations.
Matthew Rothschild, there's a phrase we should set up for those who aren't super familiar with Wisconsin. Frankly, I had never heard of this phrase before I started prepping for this program. It's this concept of the Wisconsin idea. What is the Wisconsin idea, and what does it have to do with the state's politics?
Well, the Wisconsin idea refers to the idea or the ideal behind the University of Wisconsin, which is that the university is all across the state, not just at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but the ideas in the teachings of the University of Wisconsin faculty are from all across borders of Wisconsin. Everywhere in Wisconsin, you get the benefit of the University of Wisconsin system, and also the sifting and winnowing, which is the theme of the University of Wisconsin, sifting and winnowing for the truth. So it's really an idea about fair play. It's an idea about seeking truth, and it's an idea about using the value of public higher education for every citizen of Wisconsin.
Now, you followed state politics, Matthew, for some time. As I understand it, the state hasn't been solid blue or solid red in a good while. It can be kind of all over the map, so to speak, right?
Yeah, we had Tommy Thompson, governor here for more than a decade. He is not as far right as Scott Walker, but he was a Republican for sure. And Democrats were only able to win in the presidential races in Wisconsin prior to Barack Obama by very slender margins. Gore beat Bush here by just 5,700 votes, and Kerry beat Bush here in 2004 by just 21,000 votes. So the fact that Donald Trump was able to beat Hillary Clinton by 22,000 votes wasn't that shocking to me. And actually, I was worried all along that he was going to win, because you could drive from Madison, Wisconsin, all the way to Lake Michigan, and you would never see a Hillary Clinton sign, but you would see literally hundreds of Donald Trump signs.
Yeah, one of our listeners just mentioned Tommy Thompson, in fact. Live Life tweeted, "Don't forget that Wisconsin's last Republican governor, Tommy Thompson's welfare reform plan, was key and then was adopted nationwide by Bill Clinton." Dan, you wanted to jump back in.
I did, just to say one other comment about the Wisconsin idea, which Matt articulated beautifully. It was also particularly important in the foundation of the progressive movement of the turn of the century, spearheaded by a man named Robert M. La Follette, Fighting Bob. And in that time, the Wisconsin idea really embodied this principle that the university's faculty should be used to draft legislation that would benefit the citizens of the state. So, for example, the workers' compensation bill was drafted by a guy named John Commons, an economics professor. So they wanted to draw on that expertise for a specific goal, which was to make life better for the vast majority of the state's citizens. Before workers' comp, a company if a worker was killed on the job, there would be a widow and children with no income, and they would just simply have to live with relatives or try to survive somehow. So that was an example of that in practice.
Before we pause, Steve, I wonder if you agree with the characterization of this transition as a fall for Wisconsin. How is the state doing in terms of the well-being of Wisconsinites?
If you're a progressive and you're used to being in power, it is a fall. I think that the vast majority of undecided voters, people who are not blue or red, you know, make their decision in every election based on what they think is going on in the state. And they've had three opportunities, actually four opportunities, since Scott Walker was elected. And Republicans took over both houses of the legislature to vote them out of office. And they have not decided to do that. They had their recall election in 2012 and then the regular election in 2014. And they've had legislative elections in 12, 14, and 16. And with the exception of a few months over the past 8 years, or 7 or 8 years, Republicans have been solidly in power in Madison. So the voters are always the people who get the last word. And obviously, a majority of them approve, at least don't disapprove of what Walker is doing, or they don't believe that the Democrats are a very good alternative.
Yeah, Steve, I do want to get a little bit more of your perspective on how this movement has been successful. When we continue our conversation with Steve Prestigard, Wisconsin political blogger, Matthew Rothschild, executive editor of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and Dan Kaufman, the author of The Fall of Wisconsin. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing the political shift in Wisconsin and what it might tell us about shifts in the rest of the nation. With Dan Kaufman, the author of the new book, The Fall of Wisconsin, Wisconsin political blogger and journalist Steve Prestigard, and Matthew Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. We'd love to hear from you and your perspectives on the change in power in Wisconsin. How has it affected you? Are you better off, worse off, about the same since this political shift took place? Or if you're involved in politics elsewhere in the country and you're keeping a close eye on Wisconsin, what are you watching for? What are you learning? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Steve, I'd love you to react to an email from Shannon, who's listening here in Washington. Shannon emailed, "I worked on Scott Walker's 2010 campaign and interned in his Milwaukee office right after he was elected. I think the shift in Wisconsin started then because Wisconsinites were sick of Democrats' reckless policies, which put the state in a significant budgetary deficit. Act 10's cuts put the state in a better financial position and improved Wisconsin's business standing, lowering unemployment and drawing in new companies." What about that, the case that was made by conservatives in 2010 that began this shift? Did you feel and notice that shift at the time?
It didn't appear to me that the 2010 election was going to be a real good election for Democrats, but I don't think people really realized how bad it was going to end up. What had happened before was Wisconsin had a Democratic governor in most of the 2000s. They had a Republican legislature up until the 2008 election, which was a big wave for Democrats. Well, in the 2009-2010 legislature, Governor Doyle, the Democratic governor, signed a $2.2 billion tax increase into law. And that was at the same time that he actually had to do some line item vetoes because even he believed that the spending in that budget was excessive. Well, obviously things were not that good in Wisconsin anyway because of the Great Recession, but I think that made things considerably worse. Wisconsin had a terrible reputation as far as a place to do business. There was literally not a single business climate comparison, and there are a bunch of them. They all use kind of different criteria. Every single one of them had Wisconsin somewhere between 40 and 48. They were never dead last, but Wisconsin was seen as a bad place to do business. And if your economy isn't very good, people actually started to think, I think, that maybe there's a connection there. You know, as far as Act 10 is concerned,
I think one of the things that was a key thing, you know, people did, I think, have an idea that when that Walker wanted to change the dynamic between labor government employees, basically, or really government employee unions, and government, that is, and the taxpayers. And Act 10 did that. It was obviously enormously controversial. He got recalled. A few state legislators, state senators got recalled. However, with one or two exceptions, which really didn't have anything to do with Act 10, they all survived the recall election. Mm-hmm. And you'll notice that since then, again, except for a few months, Republicans have had complete control of state governments. And I think some voters actually rewarded Walker for doing something that was bold, because one thing that Republicans are kind of known for is saying one thing and then doing less of that thing. Well, that really wasn't the case in this instance.
Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. It's true that Walker won these elections. It's also true, and this is something that Matt is a particular expert in, that there has been a flood of money in Wisconsin politics that have altered the nature of elections. For example, the recall election, Governor Walker outspent his opponent $30 million to $4 million. So it's true that he lost, and you also have gerrymandering. For example, in 2012, the Wisconsin Assembly Democrats won nearly 200,000 more votes in aggregate, and yet they lost seats. They still only had 38 seats to 60 seats by the Republicans. So I'm not sure the meaning of elections is completely definitive on what people think. A lot of my book kind of chronicles what's happened across the country, a very robust conservative infrastructure that's very capable of shaping public opinion and kind of weighing the scales on elections.
Yeah, we did hear from a number of listeners about gerrymandering. For those of you who are fans of 1A, you know it's our favorite topic on this program, one of the ones that many of you request we talk about all the time. And it definitely came up with regards to Wisconsin, including in this note that landed in our inbox.
My name is Ed. I live in central Wisconsin. You say that Wisconsin has become a conservative red state. But I disagree. It's basically because of gerrymandering by the state legislature. The case, which was to be heard by the Supreme Court, which was denied merit because of the Republican conservative dominated Supreme Court. So I disagree. It's basically disenfranchising voters.
Ed, thanks for chiming in. And of course, he's referring to the Supreme Court's decision to basically kick the case back down to a lower court for procedural reasons, questioning whether the plaintiffs had the standing to bring the matter. The money in politics aspect came up in a Facebook comment from AJ Nee, who wrote, "I was born and raised in Wisconsin. I think the most monumental shift happened with the recall election of Scott Walker in 2012. Out-of-state money flooded into that campaign, and suddenly I began hearing family and friends parroting talking points that I knew they previously did not agree with. To me, it was terrifying to see how quickly and easily people's thoughts and opinions can be bought." Matthew Rothschild, how do you see it? I'm hearing two arguments here. I'm hearing, on the one hand, that the conservatives and the Republicans had their thumb on the scale with gerrymandering with all this outside money. On the other hand, I'm hearing Wisconsin's progressive policies were weighed in the balance and found wanting. How do you see it?
Well, I think there's a combination of things. First and foremost, Walker came to power during the Great Recession. Jim Doyle, the governor, was at 34%. Unemployment wasn't real good here. It wasn't a good year, 2010, for Democrats across the country. But once they got power, they secured their power by rigging the system. There was not only the grotesque gerrymandering, one of the worst in the last 50 years in American history. There was also the voter ID law, one of the most restrictive voter ID laws in the country. And Republican state senators, when they passed that law, according to a Republican staffer, were giddy. That was his adjective. Giddy that they were disenfranchising people of color and students. And then there was the money. Dan talked about the money during the recall. And then there's the money that has kept Walker and Republican leadership in power in the state assembly, state senate, and Wisconsin Supreme Court. Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the big business lobby here in Wisconsin, has spent $20 million over the last 7 years to keep these people in power. The Koch brothers, through their group Americans for Prosperity, has spent $6 million to keep these guys in power. Betsy DeVos's group, the American Federation for Children, so-called, which works for privatizing public education, has spent $6 million to keep these folks in power. So money is a big thing. Then there's a third point, and I think it's an important one. The Walker reign in Wisconsin really represents the triumph of a four-decade nationwide effort by right-wing billionaires to change the public's perception of the proper role of government, and to get people to believe the crude propaganda that everything private is good and everything public is bad. I mean, this effort's been chronicled so well by Jane Mayer in Dark Money and Nancy McLean in her book, Democracy in Chains. And I see the results of that up close and personal right here in Wisconsin.
Before I give Steve Prestigard a chance to jump in, I should note that the Koch brothers came up in a comment from Steve Wilder in Elkhart, Indiana. That Steve emailed, one of Scott Walker's 2010 slogans was, "Stop the train." He succeeded. The planned Madison to Milwaukee high-speed train line was shelved, and the federal funds for it went to other states. Walker exploited anti-urban prejudice to kill the project on behalf of the Koch brothers. Steve Prestigard, how do you see the influence of outside money, of gerrymandering, on Wisconsin's political shift?
Well, there's two thoughts that come immediately to mind. First, I have to say that I think it is condescending and somewhat insulting to have the position that basically, you know, people would always vote the way I want them to vote, you know, the progressive way you want them to vote, if it wasn't for, insert the name of the boogeyman here, you know, big money from right-wingers or whatever, as though people are too ignorant to be able to decide for themselves that, you know, I like the Republican guy better than the Democratic guy, or the Republican position better than the Democrat position.
Well, but some of those boogeymen actually do exist. Outside money on politics does have an influence. Gerrymandering does affect elections. There is something to be said for the idea that someone can lose with a majority. Outside political influence is done because it works.
But that is how the system works. You don't get, you know, this is not a proportional representation system where if 300,000 people vote for Democrats and 200,000 people vote for Republicans, then 60 seats go to Democrats and 40 to Republicans. That is not how the system works. The second thing I would say is that I think people who complain about excessive money in politics kind of don't understand why that money exists. And the reason money exists is because government has grown in power and influence and ability to change your life, to make you do things you don't want to do, and vice versa. And that is the reason for money in politics, because the stakes for elections have increased dramatically, far beyond what anybody who was involved in the creation of the United States or the state of Wisconsin had ever intended. And my position is that everything that you don't like about politics today, in the sense of big money and nasty campaigns and all of that, is the direct result of the size of government. And if you want to change that, you need to defang government. You need to restore the concept of federalism, where the federal government doesn't decide everything. Things get decided at the appropriate level. I think, so in other words, I'm not saying that big money doesn't exist. Clearly it does.
Right.
Big money exists on all sides. And even in nonpartisan races, there's even a surprising amount of money being spent on politics at the local level. But the reason for that is the stakes in elections are so much higher today because government does far too much, taxes too much, regulates too much, and controls too much.
There are a few other perspectives on what has happened in Wisconsin. William in Dayton, Ohio, emailed, "What happened in Wisconsin was that the liberals played nice and the conservatives didn't. The liberals relied upon logic and rational persuasion, while the conservatives used emotion. The liberals preached, while the conservatives used salesmanship." Rice in Mequon, Wisconsin, emailed, I interned at the Kohler factory from 2016 to 2017, and I was wondering if I could ask if you could ask your guest how they got almost the entire workforce to vote against their own union. There were union-promoted posters supporting Clinton all over the factory, and yet most of the men I spoke with voted for Trump, even though they gave 10% of their salary to the union. How does this happen? Dan Kaufman, what about the shifting power of labor and what happened in 2016?
It's a very interesting comment, actually. I spent a lot of time at the Kohler plant interviewing some elderly strikers and then the current head of the union. And he talked to me about the difficulty of getting people to volunteer for Hillary Clinton. And in contrast to Barack Obama in 2008, he, in fact, he said he knew he was dragging people out to put up signs and he knew that they would be voting for Trump. I think what happened, frankly, is Hillary Clinton was a terrible candidate for anybody that was at all connected to the labor movement. They were, a lot of people were cognizant of her support for free trade agreements and her role as a corporate board member of Walmart. And there was very little enthusiasm for that kind of policy that has hollowed out the industrial Midwest. And I think people, you know, one thing that people forget about Donald Trump, when he was campaigning in Wisconsin, I reviewed all of his speeches in the book. He talked a lot like a Democrat in sections. There was a lot of racial and nativist resentment, but there was also a defense of Social Security, a defense of Medicare, and a real attack on NAFTA, China's admittance to the WTO, and other things that would appeal to labor-oriented, particularly white labor-oriented voters. And I think that was part of it.
Tone came up in a couple of comments that we got from some listeners. Sean wrote on our Facebook page, the anger and resentment shown toward educated elites will cripple the state in the future. The University of Wisconsin-Madison and its affiliated universities have been an economic engine driving manufacturing knowledge and bringing people from all across the world. We'll talk about the University of Wisconsin in a moment, but I want to get to a comment from Raymond, who emailed, greetings from the People's Republic of Madison, Wisconsin. I'm a lifelong conservative with a small c. I could not bring myself to vote for either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton in the last presidential election. I voted for an independent, knowing full well that I was making a statement rather than a difference. Outside the liberal bastions of Madison and Milwaukee, Wisconsin has a rural and conservative, small c, flavor to it. The election of a Republican governor and legislature after years of Democratic state government is just one example of rural disdain for heavy governmental guidance in our daily lives. Before we have to pause, Matthew Rothschild, what do you make of Raymond's comment?
Well, you know, Kathy Kramer, UW professor, has written a great book on this called The Politics of Resentment. And there is a sense in rural communities in Wisconsin, and I think around the country, and I travel around Wisconsin to rural communities, that they feel neglected, forgotten. They feel sometimes incorrectly that they're not getting their percentage of their tax dollars back to them, that it's all going to the big cities. But mostly they feel like they are being belittled. And that's why I think Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables comment was so counterproductive in rural Wisconsin. So the resentment is there. And the fact that people are resenting those who are just one rung above them on the ladder, Scott Walker calling public sector workers the haves. You know, people in rural communities in Wisconsin, they don't connect with, they don't see on a day-to-day basis the real haves. And so they do see people just a little bit above them, and they know they're working super hard and wondering why, you know, the other people have it a little bit better. And Scott Walker made a claim when he, during the recall, it was preposterous, but it seemed to work, which was that it's not fair. And we should lower everybody's standards basically down to the bottom.
I do want his brother. I'm sorry, I hate to cut you short. I do want to hear a little bit more about this when we continue. Steve, I'd also like you to chime in on this. We will talk more about the University of Wisconsin. And I should note, been hearing a lot from you Minnesotans across the state border. Got some things to say to your neighboring Wisconsinites. Is Wisconsin better off than it was before? And what does this mean for the rest of the country? Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Dan Kaufman, Matthew Rothschild, and Steve Prestigard. Steve, I wonder if you could comment on Raymond's email regarding the urban-rural divide in Wisconsin and how that's played into the politics.
Well, I think I'm trying to figure out if I know him. I might. But I think he's absolutely right. There has, and this is not, you know, contrary to what some people might think, this is not something that was just created in the last decade to benefit Republicans. The rural-urban split in this state, which is essentially Madison and Milwaukee against everybody else, is a real thing, and it's been a real thing for a very long time. I think there was a caller or commenter earlier who had talked about the Madison to Milwaukee train proposal that got spiked as soon as Walker got elected. And I was not living in the Madison area at that point. I am a native of Madison, by the way, but I haven't lived in Madison since I escaped in 1988. But I can tell you that that flew very badly throughout the rest of the state. And I can, you know, in the half dozen or so places that I lived in this state as an adult, I can tell you that the vast majority of people look at Madison with a "what idiot thing are they doing now" kind of attitude.
What was it about the train that people didn't like?
Well, number one, it only serves Madison and Milwaukee. I called it the Axis of Evil train in my previous job. It didn't. It would have helped literally nobody else in the state of Wisconsin. It would have been for, you know, yuppies from Madison to go to Milwaukee or yuppies from Milwaukee to go to Madison. And that is literally the only people that would have benefited, but at tremendous cost. And, you know, it would literally have benefited nobody else except people who, I think, in the eyes of a lot of people, don't need any more help. Matt had mentioned Kathy Kramer's book, and I've got it, and it is a very, very interesting book to read. One of the things to point out is that, you know, there's a lot of small school districts in this state, and there are people who, in those school districts, probably don't make the average or the median income, even for their entire family, in the state. And yet, those are school districts that employ school district administrators that make six-digit figures. What she was talking about with public employees being the best-paid people in those areas, in a lot of very small areas in the state of Wisconsin, is absolute reality. And you know, you can look down on people for having that attitude, but that is their attitude.
Well, I wonder, Steve, to that point, and then Dan, I'll let you jump back in, if that speaks to a little bit of what's happened, say, with the shift to the right in Wisconsin, if this is a new form of populism that's kind of risen up over the last few years that's now taken root. Is that a good way to describe it?
Well, maybe, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. One of the things that was interesting about the Trump election, for instance, and it is correct, he was the first Republican presidential candidate to win since Ronald Reagan's second term. But one of the things that's interesting about that is that, number one, Trump did not win the Republican primary. Ted Cruz did. Number two, I don't think you can find very many Republicans in elective office in this state who agree with Trump on the trade issues. And that's the funny part about where Trump is really closer to Democrats than Republicans, because I think everybody in this state who is really knows something about business in this state would believe that free trade has benefited Wisconsin. Two of the three largest industries in this state are manufacturing and agriculture. And the people who actually follow these things and know something about them would argue that free trade has been a huge benefit to Wisconsin in two of the three biggest areas. And so there's a lot of concern in this state with this stupid trade war that Trump seems to be trying to ignite and the kind of effect that that's going to have on Wisconsin's economy. I would not call that a very populist position, frankly.
Something else that a number of our listeners have said has benefited the state of Wisconsin is addressed in an email from Anna. Anna writes, perhaps you could discuss Walker's attacks, Governor Scott Walker's attacks, on the University of Wisconsin, such as slashing funding and attempts at altering the mission statement. Steve emailed, I'd be curious about the panel's comments on Scott Walker's attacks on the University of Wisconsin. A number of you also left some notes for us in our voicemail inbox. Here's what some of you said.
I was tenured at a state university in Wisconsin. Republican budget cutting so deeply damaged the quality of education provided there that I sought work at a university in another state. When I told colleagues that I was leaving after 16 years, fully three-quarters confided that they were currently looking for jobs elsewhere, too, or that they would do so at a specific point, like when their next book was published. Almost everyone else said they felt trapped in Wisconsin by family circumstances or by a resume they saw as too weak to land them a new job. My university was hemorrhaging internally, and I didn't even fully understand the severity of the wound until I was walking out the door. I hope those still seeking jobs in other states will keep on looking. At least for my own family, the grass actually is greener on the other side.
Just one of the University of Wisconsin professors and public school teachers we heard from in response to what's happened with education. Dan, what about this concern of a brain drain in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's very real. A source told me that the University of Minnesota had tried to poach an entire department of the University of Wisconsin. They weren't successful, but they did. There's been a lot of poaching of disgruntled faculty, and there's been a real both practical attacks on them, on their budget and their tenure, and there's also been a rhetorical attack on the value of their work. And just to respond quickly to one thing that Steve said, you know, he talked about the train in terms of just benefiting Madison and Milwaukee, but I mean, you can look at the University of Wisconsin. It is the biggest driver of Wisconsin's economy still. What helps Madison, which is actually one of the places that is doing the best, Dane County is growing, and that generates taxes and so on for the whole state, the same principle applies. I mean, it's interesting that it's perceived as just benefiting this one place when it's part of the state. Madison and Milwaukee are part of Wisconsin, and without the University of Wisconsin, it would be a much less renowned place.
But do we see that as unique to Wisconsin, though, Dan? I mean,
it's not. No, yeah, I think it's universal.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the state of California. Absolutely. I mean, arguably, the number one economic driver in California is the University of California system, those 10 campuses. I taught at UC Berkeley, so I'm a little biased. But even states like California have made major cuts to public education that have even Californians baffled that we would do something like that to this crown jewel of the state.
Exactly. And I think it's not really a partisan issue because you have to look. In my book, I talk, the Democrats have not been particularly supportive of public investment either. When Jim Doyle was leaving office 3 weeks before Walker's inauguration, he said, "I've cut more public employees than any governor in history." So to counter Steve's point a bit, I don't think either side has been particularly standing up for that principle. And I think that's one reason Democrats have done so poorly in Wisconsin.
Jay in St. Paul tweeted, "As a Wisconsinite living in Minnesota, I won't move back to my beloved Wisconsin due to a de-education mentality of the Wisconsin education system." Matthew Rothschild, how do you see it? Do you agree that there's a de-education mentality in Wisconsin?
Jay is absolutely right. The Republican leadership from Walker on down have been savaging teachers, slashing K through 12 education, slashing the budget for the University of Wisconsin system, which isn't just Madison, but it's all over the state, tackling tenure, taking tenure away, trying to monkey with the mission statement and dilute it and make it less visionary, certainly.
Clarify that a little bit. What were some of the changes in the mission statement that the governor wanted?
Oh, they just wanted to take out the Wisconsin idea that we were talking about before, essentially. And they got doing that, and they had to retract. But and the joke of it is now that Scott Walker is calling himself the education governor because he restored a little bit of money K through 12 and a little bit of money to the university system. He's kind of like the pyromaniac who burns stuff down by night and then puts on his firefighter outfit the next morning and tries to play the hero.
Troy emailed, "Being a competitive neighbor living in Minnesota, it's my understanding that since the Republican ascension in Wisconsin, Minnesota has been outpacing Wisconsin in almost all economic criteria, especially given that for decades the two states were nearly identical in economic data." Steve, I wonder if you could respond to that, particularly because it seems that Troy is right. There's a study that came out from the Economic Policy Institute this May that showed, among other things, job growth since 2010 has been stronger in Minnesota than in Wisconsin. Minnesota's grown 11%. Wisconsin's grown about 8%. Wages grew faster in Minnesota. The gender wage gap shrank more in Minnesota. Median household income grew by more. Minnesota made greater progress in reducing overall poverty, child poverty, and poverty as measured by the Census Bureau. It would seem like on many measures, Wisconsin and Minnesota are almost a clear control and experiment comparison. Can you say, to borrow from Ronald Reagan, that Wisconsinites are better off now than they were 4 or 8 or 10 years ago?
They keep voting for Republicans, and I think that's your answer right there.
No, I'm talking about whether they are actually demonstrably better off.
Well, I think the better question I am just answering it because people get the choice to decide whether or not they like the way things are. And they have voted for Republicans for the last 3 elections knowing how things are. So I think that's the answer. I think to be 100% blunt and nonpartisan about this, most people don't base their opinions on how their lives are going based on what happens in politics. I understand that probably is a concept that is foreign to a lot of political junkies, but I do believe that that is the case. And, you know, they make a decision for changing their vote if they think things are bad. And I don't believe that people really believe that to be the case. I do think that the Economic Policy Institute study was grossly flawed. It looks at everything from a certain political perspective. But whether or not that is flawed, the fact is that thanks to the freedom of movement that we all have, if you really like Minnesota's government better, then by all means, you ought to move to Minnesota. And if you think Wisconsin's approach is better, then you should either move to Wisconsin or stay in Wisconsin. I do think also that the comparisons are rather flawed anyway for a couple of reasons. First off, the state of Minnesota is 70% the Twin Cities. It is a considerably more rural state in that sense than Wisconsin is. Wisconsin's population is more spread out with communities like Fox Cities, Green Bay, and so on than Minnesota's population is. The second thing is that Minnesota has always had more companies and bigger companies. And this goes back literally decades. This is not anything that you can tie to Republicans or Democrats. There have always been more companies. And oh, by the way, according to a lot of the studies that I've seen, Minnesota still has lower taxes than Wisconsin has. And if the Republicans in Madison get one message, it is maybe they should be cutting taxes more than they already have.
So I just want to make sure I'm clear, Steve, because you've talked about the comparison between Minnesota and Wisconsin. I just want to be clear. Mm-hmm. Do you believe Wisconsinites are demonstrably, objectively better off in their lives today than they were before this conservative shift?
Yeah, I think they are. And, I mean, the unemployment rate is record low. Number of people in the workforce and working is the highest. Those are two indicators that I think are probably the real driver for people voting. So, yeah, I do believe that.
Will tweeted, Wisconsin politics is a microcosm of national politics, a toxic combination of identity politics, outside money, and gerrymandering. The very first caller confirmed that identity politics is why he felt the Democratic Party left him. This is the GOP strategy in Wisconsin and across the U.S. Matthew, I know we're low on time. Could you respond to that? I understand the argument about identity politics. Some people saying that the Democratic Party focuses too much on race and class and gender and sexual orientation. Depending on your perspective, it can also mean talking about things like marriage equality and black people getting shot by the police for no reason. But I understand that that's a divisive issue. Do you see that Will has a point as it relates to identity politics in Wisconsin?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that defending people's rights is a very important thing to do for Democrats, but also fighting for economic rights, fighting for jobs and higher wages and better sick leave and family leave. It's no accident that Bernie Sanders won 71 out of 72 counties here in Wisconsin in the primary because he had that kind of a pitch, and he also went after what he called the billionaire class.
Mm. Dave in Minnesota emailed, the Milwaukee to Madison train was supposed to be part of a Chicago to Minneapolis line through Rochester. Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, La Crosse, Rochester, Minneapolis. Thanks for nothing, Wisconsin. Before we go, Dan, I wonder if we could look forward politically. Scott Walker is coming up for re-election. There's a candidate named Randy Bryce who is after the seat of current House Speaker Paul Ryan. Talk about what you're seeing in Wisconsin's political future that the rest of the country should be paying attention to.
Well, it's very interesting. You see two sides of where the Democratic Party is at. The governor's race is still yet unclear. There's a lot of people running, but there doesn't seem to be anybody, at least maybe Matt can correct me, but that's sort of galvanizing people as Sanders did. And I think Randy Bryce is doing that. Whether that will be enough to win, I don't know. But you see that in reflected in campaigns like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
In New York.
And this kind of return. And Sanders' success was very meaningful in Wisconsin. And I think that model is, that's the schism in the Democratic Party right now.
Briefly, Steve, before we go, any areas where you think conservatives should remain vigilant in Wisconsin, particularly any areas of progressive or Democratic pushback that might be vulnerabilities going forward, briefly?
Well, they should always be concerned. You should always pretend that you're a couple of points behind. You know, Walker has not been able to crack 50% approval through his entire career as governor, and yet he keeps winning in the low 50s. But I think that Republicans need to act like they need to prove what it is that they have done and how they've made the state better. You should never, ever pretend that you're ahead, even if you are ahead.
Wisconsin political blogger Steve Prestigard. Steve, thanks for talking to us.
It was a pleasure.
Matthew Rothschild, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you.
And Dan Kaufman, his new book is called The Fall of Wisconsin, The Conservative Conquest of a Progressive Bastion and the Future of American Politics. Dan, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow for the Friday News Roundup. This is 1A.